Good morning, everyone. It's a real honor once again to deliver a message on the eve of Swedenborg's birthday, which is actually tomorrow, if we want to be exact and correct about it. It feels especially nice this year, given the propinquity of my recent trip to Stockholm with a group of our divinity students at the GTU in Berkeley. We spent 7 days following the footsteps of Swedenborg, and our last day was spent in Uppsala, in the great cathedral there, attending a Lutheran High Holy Mass. And there was a moment in the service when they ring the bells to think about those who have died and gone on, and we got to hear those chimes, the very same bells that Swedenborg heard many times as a child with his tomb and coffin adjacent to us in one of the side chapels. So that death, the birth 330 years ago, and here we are today. And it feels nice to celebrate his life with all of you. If Swedenborg were alive today, 330 years old, what would he have to say to our modern whizzing world of the 21st century? As someone who invented and sketched the plans for a flying machine and an automatic machine gun, one wonders how he would respond to all that our modern civilization has wrought. The wonder of something like airplanes, but also the horror of climate change, mass gun shootings, and war. And in spite of the so-called death of God that the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche proclaimed in the 19th century, and the advent of scientific materialism and secularism, Swedenborg might be further surprised at the popularity of angels in our 21st century. Angels are everywhere in America, and not just in Tony Kushner's play of the same name. We find them in television series, on bumper stickers, coffee mugs with anodyne quotes. Their place in contemporary culture would seem to mirror actual belief systems. Even though fewer and fewer Americans are going to church, and more identify as spiritual but not religious, when asked about their religious affiliations by things like the Pew Charitable Trust, a surprising broad number of people still believe in angels. According to a recent, very large and comprehensive poll undertaken by Gallup, around 73% of Americans believe in the existence of angels. Another 12% are not so sure, and only 16% of those asked said they emphatically do not believe in angels or supernatural beings of any kind. More women than men in America are likely to believe in the presence of angels, and the number of 72% of those believers has remained quite steady, while belief in hell and the devil has continued to precipitously decline. So angels in, devil out. Angels are here to stay, even if the general drift has been away from organized religion, these sets of data and survey seem to imply. So why the persistence of angels in our so-called secular age? There are many beliefs and ideas about what angels are or might be. Within Judeo-Christianity, there's actually very few clear statements in the Bible that tell us who or what angels are. Swedenborg, after his illumination and transformation of scientist into mystic, had a lot to say about angels, and they appear immediately and early on in his first major theological work, his multi-volume interpretation of Genesis, the Arcana Celestia, as we call it, or Secrets of Heaven, which he wrote, as we talked about in the children's moment, in his little summer house, parts of it. Later, Swedenborg extracted sections from his Arcana that have to do with angels in the afterlife and published it as a much smaller work, his Heaven and Hell, in 1758. And this work has remained, hands down, Swedenborg's most popular bestseller over the decades into the 19th, 20th, and 21st century. One of Swedenborg's arcana, or secrets, that he claims to reveal is that angels were not supernatural beings with wings or semi-deities, but a kind Sorry, I lost my place. Not supernatural beings with wings, semi-deities, or a kind of related or separate race of better, more holy and powerful creatures. No, says Swedenborg. Angels are, potentially, all of us. You, me, the lady sitting next to you on the bus, your neighbor down the street. The angels of heaven are simply the spirits of good people who have died and transitioned to a different state of existence. This idea was shocking to many of 18th century readers of Swedenborg. It seemed too fleshy, too human, the notion that angels would eat, have dinner parties, even have intimate relations with one another. And yet it helped launch a radical reimagining of what the afterlife was like for Western Christianity. And there's a whole realm of scholarship about the impact this had on depictions of the afterlife in the 19th century. We still might be unsettled by the idea that angels are what we humans might be within. In the Bible, there is no suggestion of angelic presences as humans other than the extreme interpretive ambiguity in both the original Hebrew and the Greek in which the Bible was written. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew malak is translated often as angel. It is the word that appears in our readings today from the Psalms. But the very same word is also used for humans who are sent as messengers by kings, leaders, or prophets to deliver important messages. The ancient world had no text messaging, no Facebook or email. So there's actually a lot of messengers moving around in the stories who are sent to give proclamations or information to others. In some cases, these messages might have been read aloud from a script or a text, kind of like an ancient telegram. In the famous story of Joshua and the city of Jericho, messengers take the center of the story when they spy out the city for Joshua and are hidden by Rahab the prostitute, who is subsequently spared destruction when Joshua's trumpets send the walls come crashing down. In the New Testament, the Greek word angelos, from which our modern English word angel descends, shares in this multiple meaning, indicating both otherworldly angelic beings that appear in dreams and regular everyday humans who do the work of delivering messages. It is angelos that are sent by John the Baptist to Jesus, for example, to ask him, "Are you the one who is to come, or are we to expect someone else?" In a way, Swedenborg's particular details about how angels engage with us amplifies these linguistic, message-giving dimensions. If we take Swedenborg at his word, heaven, or hell, are not some distant realm that we go to when we die, but states of existence we are already carrying within us. Heaven is here. Heaven is now. The Buddhist scholar D.T. Suzuki famously put it when he was asked about the parallels between Mahayana Buddhism and Swedenborg. He actually picked up a dinner spoon from the table at the conference in Switzerland and said, "This spoon is now in heaven," a very Zen koan sort of moment. Swedenborg says our soul is associated with good spirits and bad spirits who exude a constant influx or flow into our thoughts and ideas. Perhaps somewhat disconcertingly, Swedenborg claimed that every thought or impulse that comes into our consciousness isn't really generated by ourselves, but comes from our receptivity of this influx pouring into us from our associate spirits, the good angels and those not so good. This might sound quite esoteric or even bizarre to our modern ears, that angels essentially are the words in our brain. But practically speaking, in terms of what it means for the conduct of our lives, Swedenborg's teaching comes close to the purpose and point of much mindfulness training and exercise, which only seem to be increasing in their popularity. For Swedenborg, when a thought, emotion, or impulse arises in us, we are to simply observe it and consider its source. Does this come from a place of love or a wish to be of service to others? Or is it negative, focused on controlling and establishing power over those around us, something to enhance our own reputation and ego? We always have a choice, Swedenborg says, for what we choose to let in to the empty vessels of who we are. The more we detach ourselves and reject the negative, even sometimes evil impulses that come into our consciousness, this is what Swedenborg calls resisting temptation, the more the divine is able to fill us with love and truth. The less we are, the more the divine is, for we are in and of ourselves, and here again, Swedenborg and some schools of Buddhism converge, absolutely nothing. Our encounters with angels, for Swedenborg, are not exceptional rare experiences, but part of the mechanics of everyday consciousness. And yet, there is still so much in Swedenborg, as laid out in Heaven and Hell and elsewhere, that agrees with the wondrous biblical stories of angels, that sometimes these messages from heaven take on the direct and spectacular encountering of specific beings from another world. This is sometimes the space of dreams, of waking visions, the realm between waking and sleeping, but it can also be in the here and now of the day-to-day in wonderful kinds of ways. What experiences have you had of these liminal sorts of spaces that seem to defy logic or rational explanation? I have been speaking up till now somewhat abstractly, maybe even too academically, about Swedenborg. So I'd like to share two stories from my family that I would like to think, perhaps, are angelic encounters. The first concerns my grandfather, who died in Los Angeles in the 1980s after a terrible struggle with brain cancer. As he lay very sick and dying on his hospital bed, his wife, my grandmother, who still is alive, and all his children, including my father, gathered around him. My father had flown from the East Coast to visit him, and I still remember as a seven-year-old saying goodbye to him at the airport for this. One morning, my grandfather was unusually alert and healthy sounding, seeming to shake off his pain and all the heavy sedatives. "I've had a dream," he told the family energetically in a clear and distinct voice. "I was standing in a beautiful green field. Two people wearing white robes came to me while I was standing on that field, and they smiled at me. One of them said, 'You can't come with us today, but when we come back in 2 days, you will come with us then.'" 2 days later, in the afternoon, with the sunlight coming through the window, my grandfather was sleeping peacefully in his bed with my dear grandmother and the other family members sitting nearby. He woke up with a large smile on his face. He pointed up at the ceiling of the room and said, "Look." He put his arm down, closed his eyes, and was dead. I've come to think that my grandpa's last words on this earth, "Look," with an exclamation point, is like the word "behold" we find so many of the angels using in the New Testament around the advent of the Lord's birth. "Behold, I bring you tidings of great joy." It is an indicative exclamation pointing towards wonder, astonishment, joy. My second story is inexplicably entangled in this first story that has become an important part of my super family history and anecdotes about ourselves and my grandpa. It happened many years later when I was newly married, living in New York City, teaching in the aftermath of 9/11, literally. I had not thought about my grandpa Zuber in many, many years. I didn't know him that well. So I was surprised when I had a strong dream of him and my other grandfather on my mom's side, who had also passed in the 1980s, standing in front of me and smiling. Just these two presences, looking at me and me looking at them. No words. In fact, this dream was so strong that I woke momentarily up from it before falling back to sleep. I didn't think too much of this dream at the time. It just seemed a nice memory of these two men who had been a loving part of my childhood in incidental sorts of ways. In the dream, they were above me in a way that is hard to describe, but it was a feeling of being looked down upon. 2 days later, after this dream, while I was brushing my teeth, I received a devastating phone call from my father that my younger brother, Justin, had just died in an accident at his boarding school. He was 15. A rift immediately tore open my world to have my sweet younger sibling, the brother I was closest to in my family, suddenly be taken away. It seemed so meaningless, so unfair. Yet in the grieving aftermath, I then recalled this dream of my grandfather's combined presence that I had had 2 evenings prior. Did this then mean God had somehow known or foreseen that my brother would die so tragically and had let such an awful thing happen? This could easily become a kind of dilemma of the theodicy, cruelly personalized. But the more I turned the dream over in my thoughts, the more that dream of my grandfather's came to seem to be a mercy, a sign of love. It so strongly echoed my grandfather's own experience that it came to seem to be a kind of message when I remember my grandfather's 2 smiling faces in the dream, the sense of love and welcome they both held. If Swedenborg was right about the spiritual world, heaven and hell, being an inner dimension that transcends time and space, my grandfathers had drawn closer to my family in a time of great need when we could respectively use all the spiritual help that we could get. For he shall give you his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways, as the psalm goes. And we know from the account of Christ's temptation that after those terrible 40 days with Satan in the desert of trial and tribulation, the angels came and ministered to him. I would hazard that many of you have similar, seemingly inexplicable, irrational stories where you have been ministered to by angels. May we all be alert to listen to these messengers and messages in the coming week, the angels among us in our everyday. Amen.